in 82, and Professor David Bridges of University of Virginia is visiting us. Please, tell a little bit about your backgrounds, especially in mathematical physics. How does it happen? Did it happen that you become interested in this particular subject?
In some sense, I always was interested in science as a whole, and I slowly narrowed the focus down as it became clearer and clearer which parts of science I was not good at. I discarded them until I was left with mathematical physics.
The beginning was not mathematics but physics. Moved from physics to mathematics, or from mathematics to physics.
Well, the beginning was a sort of just overall general curiosity about engineering and in physics and chemistry and biochemistry. And as time went on, I just found that I should gravitate towards those things that need least exercise of memory, because the memory was not very good. So I discarded chemistry and biochemistry rather hastily and came down to things like physics and mathematics.
And this was what place?
Well, this is just as I was growing up. Although I was in no sense a brilliant fellow at a young age, I was always very curious at a young age.
Mm-hmm. But during your undergraduate years at Cambridge, England, I believe this was, yes?
Right, yes.
And at that time you have considered yourself as a future mathematician or future physicist?
No, at that time I considered myself as a future theoretical physicist, yes. And mathematics, I had an interest in mathematics because of certain good teachers in high school, and I guess it was also self-generated too. The earliest interest I can remember having was I learned how to solve quadratic equations, and then I looked in an encyclopedia for about cubic equations, and they gave a very peculiar looking formula there, which I then tried to derive and I couldn't. And after looking in more and more books, and this was, I guess I was quite young then, I eventually found out how they did it. I was never able to do it for myself, which disgusted me a whole lot.
But this was at the age of 14 or 15?
Younger. I was somewhere around the ages of 10 to 12.
Oh, great. Now, changing subject. This is a very, of course, popular and very dramatically developing area, this field theory, which probably all these developments, I think, the beginning was the end of 60s, might be, or the beginning. End of 60s or beginning of 70s.
Well, no, I think it's earlier than that. Weitmann wrote down what axioms would define a field theory in a mathematical sense earlier than the 60s, 50s, I think, even.
But certainly mathematicians were not involved very much. Weitmann is not a mathematician, or is he?
Oh, he is, yes. He's in both, I think he's in both the mathematics and the physics departments at Princeton. Can't swear to that, but I think he certainly came across as a mathematician to all the physicists, and I can.
But
remember,
it was not a mass movement, I think, in mathematics.
A mass movement in mathematics as a whole. No, his school was rather small, and it really demanded a great knowledge of several complex variables, and he had a number of people: Epstein, Bruce, Glaser, Hall. And these people were rather ultimate in being able to compute domains of holomorphy and other things like that, very hard problems which they were able to deal with. And what they were doing was taking the axioms, as Weitmann and Gordy, now he's certainly a mathematician, were responsible for the axioms. They were taking them and they were trying to deduce in advance of knowing really whether there was anything very interesting that satisfied them, what the properties of that thing would be. And they managed to prove a number of very famous theorems now. And they were also attempting to actually construct, towards the end of that development, they were trying to actually find quantum field theories that satisfied the axioms by doing something analogous to Cauchy's formula. They wanted to compute the domain of holomorphy of the correlation functions of the field theory, and then they wanted to reconstruct the correlation functions, knowing what their boundary values were, on the domain of holomorphy, but that never worked.
I see.
Very well.
So I don't know, might be at that period of time these developments influenced some way theory of complex variables.
Yes, the edge of the wedge theorem, things like that were.
But certainly the relation to probability theory was discovered much later.
Mm-hmm.
And here I believe I am right, this was the end of 60s or the beginning of 70s.
I think it's 66 that Nelson, Weitzman started off when his program really came to an end, in the sense that he was not able to reach the objectives he wanted to, just several complex variables and the axioms, he then started off the idea that we should construct a quantum field theory obeying these axioms, and his idea was that we should do exactly what the physicists told us would work and just try and make it work in a rigorous sense. So his student was Nelson and his other student was Jaffe. He had others besides, but these were the very successful ones. And Nelson was truly original, because he found a way of getting a fundamental estimate on the Hamiltonian of the field theory using probabilistic methods. And that thing that he did really was the main theorem that drove the subject for several years, for many years after that.
My impression was that Nelson at this time was quite mature, not a student. At least my impression.
Yes, maybe I'm wrong, because he came from Chicago. I think he came from...
Yes,
that's
and
right.
Siegel was his supervisor at all.
Yes, I think maybe you're right there. Yes.
So he probably was a colleague of Weitzman rather than a student.
I think you're right,
And I also told that these ideas by Nelson were originated at a conference and a meeting with semantics.
Maybe that's true of the very first one, but semantic, the way I understood it was that semantic had a very important part to play in the next thing that Nelson did. This first thing was a rather clumsy application of probability by the standards of probability. It was nothing more than the Chebyshev inequality and the Feynman-Katz formula. There was no conceptual, there was no conceptual connection between probability and field theory at this stage. It was introduced solely as a tool.
I see.
As a technical help.
But this free field and hyperconductivity.
That came later, yes. That came, roughly speaking, in 74, I would say. 10 years later on this. Mm-hmm. In fact, Nelson seems to produce something great every 10 years, as far as I can tell. He also, on a slightly less magnificent scale, was the originator of analytic vectors, or some way of proving.
Yes, I know his other work. He has published a number of interesting papers on probability, and he used to send me to Moscow for many years. But after Nelson, of course, Nelson had hopes that this Markov property of fields would be very substantial for developing theory. And it turned out that up to now nobody was able to prove this global Markov property.
The global Markov property, I think, has been proved not for, I don't know whether it's proved for continuum 542, I think it has not been, but it has been proved for lattice 542 models, apparently. Now that problem is one of these problems where people keep coming out with proofs and then finding there's a mistake in it, but this particular version has been around for quite a while, so perhaps it's right now. But there are at least, well, Newman came up with a proof which had a mistake in it. Then Hugh Crone came up, together they came up with at least two proofs with mistakes in them. And I think the remaining proof is still theirs, and it probably does not have a mistake in it.
Who has done this?
Hugh Crone, two people.
Oh, Hugh Crone?
Yes.
Crone and then Bavaria.
That's right, yes.
Yes, mm-hmm. But they proved only this trigonometric situation.
They've done it on a, I think they've done it on a lattice, haven't they? That's what I was told. I haven't seen any of
how long papers. Ago?
Only a couple of years or a year or something like that. But only on, this is things I'm told.
I don't know, might be. They certainly have published something which they have recalled back a few years ago.
Uh-huh.
They found, discovered a mistake. So I'm not sure, might be, but in this case, this is a rather recent development.
Okay, in that case, I may be wrong here. I haven't followed the global mark properly.
Yes, this is not particularly interesting.
Well, it's important for conceptual foundations of quantum field theory, but it's not a technical tool which one has to have in order to make progress in other questions.
Yes, and the next substantial step has been done by Grimm and Jaffer, who picked up the leadership at the next stage after Nelson.
Glimm was in there at the beginning. I think at roughly the same time as Nelson produced his boundedness below proof, somewhere around 66, I think it was maybe 68 for Glimm, he produced the analogous result, but for a fermion field theory. And I think he was working on his own at the time. That paper's certainly written on his own. And that's also a tour de force. Then Glimm and Jaffe got together, and they did several things. They first found alternative ways of getting what Nelson had got, but those were really simplified versions of what they were really after, which was the first three-dimensional field theory, and they achieved that. I don't exactly know the date, somewhere around 74 or so. And that was one of the hardest things ever proved in field theory and remains so. It's a very, very long paper, full of ideas.
Has anybody read it carefully from the beginning?
Yes, very few people have read it carefully from beginning to end, because it takes an unusual person to read this paper, but enough people have read it carefully from beginning to end to be sure that it's correct. And in fact, it also has generated a number of papers since then. Their students, the stronger and tougher of their students, would read this and develop it. And in particular, Magnin and Seignior, the two French people, turned out to be among the ultimate in the ability to do complicated expansions, and they have developed it in all sorts of directions. So in this paper are all sorts of ideas which have since then become popular, but they were only implicit in this paper, like the renormalization group ideas were implicitly in this paper. And they, Glimm and Jaffe told me that they knew how to do it before the year it finally came out, but they just couldn't conceive of writing it down. It seemed so complicated. And what finally was able to make them help them write it down was that Nelson came up with this conceptual realization of Euclidean field theory, and that simplified what the formulas to such an extent that then they could imagine writing it down. They were intending to go ahead and write it without that. They just hadn't quite got their nerve up to do it, I think, and this helped them out. But it also meant that they viewed, for some time afterwards, they viewed Nelson's contribution as as somewhat in the nature of a technical tool, because they felt they could have lived without it. It was only a little bit after that that when Nelson again came in with a good idea, which was he showed that he suggested, in fact, he never wrote anything on it himself, he suggested to Simon Guerra and Nelson that a Euclidean Markov field was a limit of finite difference problems, and those finite difference problems are ferromagnetic spin systems. And then all of that, all of the techniques from statistical mechanics became available. And at that point it became very clear to even the most technically minded people in quantum field theory that Nelson's contribution was not merely a nicer way of writing formulas, it was a way of deriving results that could not be got any other way.
Even formalism sometimes would be very substantial, of course.
That's right, but you have, these are really strong people, you know. Somebody once told me that Newton always had such terrible notations for calculus in comparison with Leibniz, because he just didn't really care what things looked like, he knew how to think about them anyway. And Glim and Jaffe were in a similar frame of mind. They knew how to solve almost every problem they wanted to, and the writing of it out was something that they wanted to do as quickly as possible so they could go on to the next one. And that's what they did. And for a long period of 5 or 6 years or more, 10 years, they just produced this endless string of extremely difficult papers to read, but very powerful progress.
And you have picked up this subject from whom?
Well, my advisor, I came here in 1970, and the first 2 or 3 years I was not knowing what I was doing, I was just learning mathematics. But my advisor was Paul Federbusch at the University of Michigan, and he had become interested in field theory. He had a background in other places too, because Jaffe had come and given a very inspiring talk in Ann Arbor, and he immediately found an alternative way of proving one of these boundedness below results. And then he started writing various papers in it, and I signed on with him to be his student. And he immediately tried to get rid of me by using a tactic that he does on all students who come up to potentially have him as their advisor. He said, "Well, here is a set of notes that I've just acquired. Why don't you take them away and read them just to get the flavor of the subject?" And he always would hand out a very unpleasant set of notes, very hard to read. And most students would take these things away and say, "I'm never going to be able to read this stuff." But then they also would never have the nerve to hand the notes back. They would just disappear and never be seen again. Mm-hmm. And I had the good fortune not to really have had any mathematics. I had been as an undergraduate at Cambridge, I had learned everything from the physics end, which meant I knew what mathematics, physics undergraduates would know. And so I didn't know there was any very attractive mathematics. And so I just said, "Okay, if this is what you have to do, this is what you have to do." And I did it, and I kept coming back, which was very lucky for me. I just think that if I'd been in a few more graduate courses in mathematics and learned some of the less grueling kinds of notational and technical stuff, I might not have come back.
Yeah.
So.
Then you, for some time, you work together with a group of other people like Frederick Spencer.
No, that came almost more recent. That's more recently, I suppose. But firstly, I just worked with Paul. And we were a rather isolated group, and we kept on. I remember being very depressed because we heard about these Markov fields months after everybody else had done it. And I had the feeling that the people who were next door to where these were happening were just like papers like mad. And by the time we came along to hear about them, there wasn't much left to be done. We worked together in Michigan on our own, and we worked in statistical mechanics. It was just impossible to stay in field theory at that point, because everything that was, which could easily be done, was being done right away by the people who were at the centers where the new developments came out. It's very busy. But we worked in statistical mechanics. We used ideas from field theory in statistical mechanics. And then in 76, I left University of Michigan, and I was a postdoc working for Glim at Rockefeller. And it was at the end of my postdoc period there, 78, 2 years later, that I started working with Seiler and Froelich on field theories. And since then, I seem to have been in collaborations with them.
So this is approximately four years?
Right, yeah. Since then, it seems that, it's just nice. I like working with other people. I've been in collaborations most of the time since then.
Mm-hmm. And this more specific question, this idea of random walk representation, how it has occurred?
Well, when I was at Rockefeller, Tom Spencer was struggling with a very hard problem and to do with rotator models, which he finally solved 2 or 3 years later in the course of the outer space transition work that he did with Froelich. But he suggested, among as a sort of small part of what he was working on, one of his approaches involved looking at Gaussian models which had a random mass. There was a measure on the mass of the at every site there was an e to the minus m squared phi squared, and the m squared is distributed according to some independent measure for each site.
Which, and from our point of view, is scaling measure.
Well, the it's not quite, because you have a different killing at each site.
So
that's, he wanted to know if such a theory always had a mass or not, because it could be that the measure that distributes this mass could be very close to being zero most of the time, or something like that. And the answer is pretty obviously yes, in fact, but we, whether it was a proof or not was another question. And Federbusch was visiting there at the same time, and he almost totally solved the problem by saying, well, look, there's a formula for the inverse of Laplace in which you can write in terms of random walks, except that he wrote them as sums over random sets rather than walks indexed by time. And in fact, that was a good way of writing it for this particular problem. It made it easier to deal with the random walks. The main object that you looked at were the visiting numbers for each site rather than the time spent at each site. And the visiting numbers being discrete either had to be 0 or 1, and that gave you enough extra control more. But the difference between 0 and 1 being a large number was enough to give you to solve this problem, and I just tacked in a little extra idea using oscillator the Schrader positivity, and we wrote a paper together on that model. And I always liked that representation ever since then, but it didn't seem very powerful in terms of the needs of field theory, and so the whole thing lay dormant for some years after that, until about a couple of years ago. Since it would be impolite to say who has which ideas in a collaboration, I think I'll just say that the three of us, Froelich and Spencer and myself, managed to kick this representation one step further, which was a big step, and it became quite powerful after that.
And what step do you...
Main one is the one that goes, the idea of combining with correlation inequalities in a certain way to get the Gaussian domination results and things like that.
I see. So the representation itself was easier for you than the idea, or was earlier than the idea to connect this correlation inequalities?
The representation, in this earlier paper by Federbusch and myself, there's a precursor to this representation. It's I don't think we realized at that stage that it would be very convenient to write the representation for essentially arbitrary functions and to convert it into an integration by parts formula as we had then. We just knew that we could write it for any moment, but we didn't really know the form that it was finally written in the later paper.
But you have this summation.
We have a summation over walks, right? And we have a modification of the single spin measure. Now we were only dealing with random mass Gaussian models at that stage, so it's somewhat implicit there. But we knew, in particular, Tom and Jürgen and I knew that you could write it for more general things. And in fact, Jörg worked quite hard on that for some time afterwards, trying to extend it in all sorts of directions. And he came up with a large number of pretty interesting results, but most of them are what I would call soft results because they couldn't tell you anything very interesting about the continuum. They could only tell you about lattice models. And because our main thrust was the continuum theories, those results were really just lay on the side, and he never really wrote them up. Until later, of course, when we all came back together again and made the next step, and of course he realized that this would be an appropriate time to include lots of those results, and he did.
So next step was what? Gaussian domination?
Gaussian domination, right, yes.
Which is, of course, very easy to prove if you know what you want to prove.
Well, Gaussian...
Your representation.
But Gaussian...
The proof is just for us one line.
That's right, yes. The Gaussian domination, in fact, was already known beforehand in a slightly weaker form. Chuck Newman had proved that.
Yes, yes.
The main point about this representation is that it proves it in a very transparent manner and suggests all sorts of other things that you can try next. And that's what happened. And the obvious... Simon's inequalities, right.
All this continuation you told us.
Yes, and in particular, it's fairly instantaneous. As soon as you see that you can get an upper bound, then it's pretty obvious you can get a lower bound, and that leads to the idea that you might be able to prove that 5-4 field theories are trivial in more than four dimensions. And Frelich exploited that idea in the paper. He was a little bit unlucky because Eisenmann had... just got in there first in some sense, but in fact this whole development was taking place at much the same time as Eisenmann's was, and we were unlucky to be...
This is not conquering North Pole, so probably it doesn't make a very great difference who was a little bit ahead. Methods are the same or different?
The methods are philosophically the same. He has a way of writing the Ising model using rather similar kinds of ideas with random walks. What he does is take the Ising model and make a high temperature expansion and then pick some random walks, actually the random currents is what he calls it, which is slightly more inconvenient to deal with, out of the high temperature expansion, and then he can prove very similar inequalities to the ones we can get. The only thing is that although they're very similar in philosophy, they are actually different. There are some things we can get far more easily than he can, and there are some things he can get more easily than we can. His methods are really very good for the Ising model, and I would say a little bit clumsy for field theories. And our methods are naturally for field theories, and they can go down to the Ising model because we can take limits of field theories to get Ising models, but that is also maybe a little bit clumsy. So his somehow answers questions about Ising models with great precision and can be boosted to give you information on field theories by approximating field theories by Ising models, and ours start on the field theories and they go backwards. And he's a very original mind who in fact managed to anticipate almost all the things that the three of us together have done, one way or another for the Ising model or on his own.